Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hey, buddy. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk USA with me, Al Murray, James Holland, and of course, John McManus, tolerating our inane, limey banter. blimey. How are you, John?
Doing great. No complaints.
Have you caught any of Masters of the Air yet? Have you seen any?
Oh, yeah. I've seen all three episodes, and oh, my gosh.
What are you making of it?
I'm really enthralled. I love it. I mean, I think the book is just brilliant, and it's sort of manifesting on screen the way I hoped. Have you guys seen it?
I've seen the first three. Yeah, I think it's amazing. Yeah.
So well done.
I think so well done.
I thought the Schweinfurt raid was Regensburg raid.
Oh,
was just...
God, yeah. Well, and it was accurate. It wasn't cartoonish in the sense of, oh, everything's slaughtered or whatever. Some people are okay. Other people are completely in the box here. And getting nailed, and they had the numbers right, and it's really well done.
Yeah, it's really, really well done, and captures that the way they told the story of, well, if this plan works, it'll work, and if it doesn't, we're done for. And
I just thought
we're really in trouble. I thought that was excellently done, and also the idea of flying to Africa as some sort of solution to the problem as well is completely bananas. I mean, you do wonder if they'd turned around and gone back to the UK. Whether that would have taken some of the pressure off the fighter response that the second wave then had to deal with. But anyway, I mean, it looks amazing as well. The scenes where the fortress is falling apart and then flying through is absolutely incredible. Anyway.
It doesn't look fake CGI-ish.
No.
The other thing that was amazing was that shot of them going across the Alps. And, the contrails, the mountains, the clouds. I mean, it was just absolutely stunning.
Oh, the contrails are dead on.
Dead on. And John Orloff, friend of the show who wrote it, he made the point, you need to see it on as big a screen as possible because there's so much going on in every single frame. I mean, it is just not one for the iPad. Although actually, I'm going to watch it again, that third episode, because there's so much to look at. I do want to have another go at it. I think it's absolutely amazing. I mean, I've got to say, John, over here in the UK, it's had amazing reviews. I mean, literally 5-star across the board. You know, TV reviewers are known for their cynicism.
But we're not, this isn't a TV review show though. We're here to talk about something, Jim, that you want to get off your chest. And I found a quote that I think goes with it really, really well. They do not understand the problems and do not know what I am talking about.
Oh yes. Is that Major General Fred Walker, by any chance?
It certainly is. They do not understand the problems and do not know what I'm talking about. So what are we talking about? What are the problems, Jim?
Well, we're talking about 36th Texan Division, the T-Patchers crossing of the River Rapido, which is actually the Garigliano, just south of Casino on the 20th and 21st of January 1944. And this is a very, very controversial moment, not particularly so at the time, but becomes so later on because it actually begets a congressional hearing because the Texans complain after the war. And Clark is General Mark Clark, commander of the Fifth Army, we may have mentioned before on this show. And
I don't think we've heard about him at all, nor Alexander. I don't know what...
These mystery men of the Second World War, John, I don't know.
And... You know, they basically accuse him of cocking it all up and it's all his fault. And it's completely dismissed. And it's absolutely, you know, it's ludicrous that it's the army commander should take the blame for a river crossing that doesn't go entirely according to plan. And but anyway, the narrative of it is very much that Walker was wrong, that he was sent to do Mission Impossible, that they should never have done it, that they should never have ordered the Texans to go across this in this suicidal way and blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of, you know, that's when you read books about this narrative, you know, secondary sources, which admittedly I haven't read for a long time, but you know, 10, 12 years ago, I was reading a lot about this. That was the narrative, you know, that Fred Walker, the commander of the 36th, was very much the wronged man and that all those guys that were killed in the process were kind of lambs to slaughter and all the rest of it. But anyway, I've been going over this in forensic detail and I've got a slightly different view, which is probably not really surprising. But
oh, yeah.
But I'm not sure that, I mean, it was a tough gig. There's absolutely no question about that. But the problem I've got is that Fred Walker, okay, so he is given kind of specific orders that his division is going to be doing this on the 16th of January, so 4 days before. However, it has been, they all know from the beginning of December that they're going to, this is the plan, is to cross the Rapido because this is part of an earlier plan. And Clark and Jeffrey Keyes, who is the two corps commanders, so one up from Walker, have intimated very, very strongly that it's going to be the Texans that do this. So Walker knows from the beginning of January that it is almost certainly going to be the Texans that are going to cross the Rapido. And so starts giving this very, very, very careful thought. And on the 8th of January, he writes in his diary, I've been giving this lots of thought and I've come to the conclusion that it's not possible. You know, this is always sort of, you know, seen as his foresight and that even then he knew that this was an impossible mission and all the rest of it. But I was looking at this and I was thinking, hang on a minute, but he doesn't know what the other plan is and he doesn't know what assets he's got and he has no idea what artillery support he's going to be given. He doesn't know what extra troops he's going to be given. He doesn't know that this is going to be third off the rack of a whole load of other operations, not least British 10 Corps in the south over the Garigliano and then a second operation from the British 46th Division. He doesn't know that the French are going to be kind of kicking off in the north of Casino. He has no idea at this point what troops are going to be opposite him because the Germans don't know what troops are going to be opposite him on the 8th of January. You know, they've got a whole load of troops there and they've pulled them out of the line and then put them back again. But he doesn't know that. So how on earth can he say that? And then you get into the kind of nitty gritty of it and you can see that he's working himself up into a lather. So he says to Clark and to Keyes, look, why don't we attack across the Rapido north of Casino in that kind of valley where you drop down for the sort of Monte Mayo massive. Then you've got a mile and a half cross, the little Rapido going over. It's a bit more fordable there. And then, of course, you've got the Monte Casino massive, like this wall of mountains rising up to Monte Carlo, which is sort of 6,000 foot high. And they go, that's not really going to work because you're not going to get through the Gustav line there. You might be able to get across the Rapido at that point, but you won't be able to get across the Gustav line because you've got a whopping great mountain. The whole point is to get into the Liri Valley, and this is coordinated with a whole load of other operations that are going to take place. And the reason we're going to do it when we're going to do it is because we're also going to be mounting an amphibious operation at Anzio, and we want to draw off troops. So that's a complete no-no. I mean, it's a total non-starter. And when he does get his orders, he gets a really hefty amount of artillery, something like 15 field battalions of just field artillery, then on top of that kind of tank destroyer battalion, then three battalions of Sherman tanks, plus an anti-aircraft battalion, which can be used in a kind of ground attack role, sort of, you know, horizontal role, plus two extra battalions of engineers from Fifth Army, plus engineers from First Armored Division, which are also in the area. So his 16,000 strong infantry division is suddenly swollen to about kind of 20,000 plus with all those extra elements. And it's coming on the end of quite a lot of other operations. And he says in his kind of post-war notes, he says that, you know, and I looked at this and I thought to myself, I racked my brains and I thought, you know, I can't think of a single instant in history where an attacking force has had to cross an unfordable river along the enemy's main line of resistance.
And you think, well, I mean, I would say...
What's wrong with the Volturno, well, for start off with?
Exactly.
And the Biferno, and the Sangro, and the Moro, and frankly, the Garigliano 2 days earlier. I mean...
And plenty of times for the Germans on the Eastern Front and or on the Western Front, or, I mean, who knows what else. So he didn't really study history very carefully. And you think about it, Jim, what do you have, like 400 tubes or something like that in support? The U.S. Army in particular, I mean, all we do is river crossings in the course of the European campaign. And the Volturno really is sort of the best comparison because it's just a couple months earlier. And in Italy, but done by the 3rd ID primarily. And so... Yeah, it really is interesting how you brought this up, because there's always been this kind of standard thought of how this was just kind of hopeless. But when you look at it from this light and you compare it maybe to other operations, it doesn't look that different than later and previous river crossings. You know what I mean? That's what kind of gets me.
So he says, I discussed the problem with my staff and my subordinate commanders. How is infantry confined to 4 narrow crossing sites because of insufficient crossing equipment to survive disorganization and casualties in advance to and capture the main line of resistance during darkness or soon after daylight? For there could be no success until the German line of strong points was in our possession. How can assault troops build up a fighting formation by infiltration in the dark over unfamiliar ground with no landmarks to establish location and direction after crossing the river under fire? How can troop leaders exercise proper control under such conditions? How can artillery support such a manoeuvre when it can put down no observed fires during the night but must resort to map firing? How can the German defenders be kept down within their defences when restricted ammunition supplies limit preparatory bombardment to only 30 minutes? It's like, this is absolutely bonkers. I mean,
well, this is the real it's my first day stuff, this, isn't it?
It is. You know, all he had to do, he's saying, how can, all he had to do was study 2 months earlier what the 3rd ID had done at the Volturno. I mean,
right.
So to learn the answers to some of those questions. Well, and the other thing, you know, Jim, you mentioned earlier, the anti-aircraft units, those are really powerful ground support units. Those are quad 50s that can be oriented downward for direct fire support. I mean, that is very effective in the course of this war, much less the artillery.
When I ask you this question, were they used in the battle? What do you think the answer is going to be?
Well, then they weren't, and that's
weren't.
Part of the problem.
Were those 3 tank battalions used in the battle?
They're not used to any great extent, and they're
not used
part of the problem
at
too.
All. At
yeah,
all.
Exactly.
So the other thing, I mean, it gets worse. So I would answer to all those questions, I would say to Fred Walker, I would say, night operations is kind of standard, and you can always see light, and there is always light because of flashes and fire and flares and moonlight and a whole host of other reasons you can always see. And the other thing I would say is 30 minutes preliminary bombardment, but you've been bombing the shit out of these guys for a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I've got German accounts saying we spent literally 24 hours, you know, 7 days a week in our bunker, cowering with our helmets on because we were being shelled the whole time. And the 30 minutes thing suggests, that is suggestive that all they're getting is 30 minutes of artillery, which is not the case. They're getting creeping barrages going back the whole time. So the first lot of barrages, 30 minutes is on the forward positions of the Germans and then back and back and back. And it's not like, you know, the whole kind of sort of the other accusation is, you know, they only have 4 days, they didn't have time to kind of prepare properly. Well, again, that's not true because Walker had 3 weeks to do it effectively because he knew it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And they were doing active patrol work and they were skipping across the river every single night and discovering, you know, where all the positions were. So they knew where the positions are. So how can artillery hit targets when they can't see them at night? Well, A, you can because you see where explosions land. B, you fire on preset positions which you've worked out beforehand by looking at the map and looking at aerial photographs, and you don't need to actually see it. And the whole point about fire is it's indirect anyway.
Well, here's what stands out to me as far as the larger tendency. Walker, in this sense, is more symptomatic of a mindset that is there for the U.S. Army
really the U.S. ground forces in this war all the way through until the night vision era, I would argue, that there's a tendency to fight a 9-to-5 kind of war of saying, well, we don't really do night operations. That's not, we hunker down at night into holes and we shoot at anything that moves is the tendency. And when you're talking about river crossings, it makes the most sense to do that at night. And, you know, of course, there's outliers. It had happened, like at the Volturno, and it's going to happen later at the Mirth River. I mean, we could go into tons of examples.
But John, also, the other thing is that, you know, from a bridging point of view, this is technically, it's a lot easier because the Garigliano, where let's say 5th Division have just crossed two nights earlier, is about 45 yards wide. You know, here it's maybe 10, you know, maybe 8 yards wide, something like that. I mean, you know, it's not wide at all. So from a you know, from that sort of Meccano work of a Bailey bridge, it's a comparative cinch. The other thing is, why doesn't Walker go and talk to McCreary and, you know, Gregson Ellis and, you know, Douglas Graham, who are the other commanders, and go, give me your thoughts? I mean, there's no evidence of him doing that whatsoever. And you know, the Garigliano, I mean, you know, if you ever go down there, what you're seeing is a huge floodplain either side that you know, the infantry got to advance up to through a hell of a lot of mines. And then they've got to get across this 45-yard, you know, 50-yard river. Then they've got quite a long stretch, you know, of a kind of a mile or so to the hills on the other side. Well, certainly in the 5th Division area, less so in the 56th Division area. But, you know, the Germans are looking down the whole time. And they are getting shelled and really badly mashed up. I mean, it's a horror story, but they get across. And they've got rafts and stuff. And I don't know. I mean, then you kind of look at the kind of detail of it. And you look at the crossing point. So the mines running up to the river sort of zigzags down from Cassino across the whole of this Leary Valley. And the Leary Valley is about kind of 5 miles wide, running kind of at this point, kind of north to south. And the Rapido River that they've got across, it sort of ziggles, ziggles, ziggles all the way down. And about halfway down is this little village perched on a sort of low bluff of, you know, maybe kind of 20 foot high, called Sant'Angelo in Theodici. And that's a kind of sort of halfway point. And running parallel on the eastern side of the river is this road, this sort of lateral road, which follows the kind of course of the river southwards. Between that and the river is a kind of floodplain. So the road is slightly raised, and behind it, then the ground starts to climb again a little bit. But there's a floodplain there. Then there is a great big fat dike kind of on the side of the river between the river edge and the riverbank and the floodplain. And it is that bit that is mined. And that's the bit they've got to clear. And when they move down to the river with their boats to get across the river, they've got to get through this minefield. But obviously the sappers have been in, the engineers have been in and cleared these paths the nights before. But obviously it makes sense to put your crossing points where the road is closest to the floodplain, i.e. where the floodplain is at its narrowest, which the 143rd Infantry, which are attacking in two places to the south of Sant'Angelo, do. But the 141st Infantry to the north absolutely do not. They do it in literally the worst point you could possibly cross is where they cross. Too close to Sant'Angelo, so they can be seen from Sant'Angelo, and, you know, snipers and OPs and stuff in Sant'Angelo can look down on it. But also, it's literally about a kilometre, you know, what's that, two-thirds of a mile, from the road to the river. So they've got to walk this, you know, and that's obviously a harder job for the engineers to clean the mines. They've also got to, you know, there's more room for cock-up, isn't there? The bigger the minefield, the more room there is for cock-up. And of course, it's a total cock-up because they get there to their boats, find some of them being smashed. Then they've got to reallocate who's going in what boat. Then they get across. The engineers who are leading them across, it's dark because there's a fog over there's a sort of river mist over there. No one can see everything, so they get lost. Then they realise they've got to turn around again. So they then turn around. That causes lots of noise and crashing and clanking and banging into one another. The Germans get wind of it, start shelling them, and it all goes pear-shaped.
Well, I wonder, I mean, these guys had been through the nightmare of San Pietro,
yeah,
what, about a month or so before. I wonder if that's diminished their capability somewhat, or maybe their aggressiveness on the part of their commanders. I don't know. I've always wondered that. What do you think?
Well, I do, because I think what's happened is they've suddenly got a lot of replacements in who are suddenly new boys. And actually, I don't think they're as well trained.
But Walker's heart's not in it either. Because who is Walker? How, you know, I mean, he's old, isn't he? He's 56, so he's older than most of his peer group, isn't he? He's not very well, as I understand it. He's been around the block. He's probably thinking, why am I only a divisional commander when people who are young, you know, much younger than me, Clark's much younger than him.
10 years.
His heart's not in it. He regards the Italian campaign as one mountain mass after another, doesn't he? Like it's, you know, is there not a way around doing this? And his heart, it's very, very simple. His heart's not in it. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because you say, okay, so they've got lots of replacements. Well, that's his responsibility to make sure that they're therefore ready, up to the job and well-trained enough and on the ball. So you can't lay it on the replacements. You can't lay it on the fact that maybe the division's a bit windy after San Pietro and all that sort of stuff. Who's it? Where does the buck stop? And it stops with Walker, doesn't it? Surely.
Yeah, well, this is my point, because I think divisional commanders have a really, you know, a vital role. You know, they offer leadership and command, and they create a mood. You know, if the gung-ho aggressive divisional commander has a gung-ho aggressive division, you know, the cautious one has a cautious division. The spick and span man wants all his men to be wearing ties and, you know, boot polish. The casual one, like Terry Delamaze or Allen, doesn't care. You know, so the culture and the mood and everything comes down from the top, and it filters down like osmosis, doesn't it?
Well, and the classic example, I keep making this point, but the classic example is the third ID at the Volturno that's under Truscott and really doesn't even have as much support as everything you've just outlined for this operation. And maybe this is a tougher operation, granted, but still, the culture of these two units couldn't be any different based on the commander. And they're both good units, don't get me wrong. But Walker does, Al, I think you're right, Walker does set that tone, which, of course, his regimental commanders are going to pick up on, his staff quite meaningfully, too, I think, on a lot of levels, and does seep forward in a way that I think doesn't work out well in this instance. And Truscott's just cut from a different cloth.
Well, I think the trouble is once you... So I've just put a line that I wrote this morning. I put, Walker had been thinking about this operation for the best part of 3 weeks, yet rather than trying to work out solutions, he'd allowed himself to find only further reasons why the mission was surely doomed. And I think the problem is once you think it's all going to go pear-shaped, that's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it?
It can be. I mean, there are other times when you go through with it because you believe in it, but you realize the problems. Another example I'd say is the two U.S. airborne divisions in Normandy. You know, Lee Mallory has his concerns, and of course all of this goes before Taylor and Ridgway. And they, you know, they understand what Lee Mallory is saying. Hey, you know, we can get decimated going into the Cote Sainte-Tin, but we believe in this mission, and it has to be done, and Utah Beach is untenable without us. Walker maybe just doesn't have that same orientation here, thinking, this is the key to what we're doing in Italy this month in January 44 with what happens at Anzio and here and slipping past Cassino, all of that. Maybe he just doesn't quite see it that way.
He's thinking it's just another mountain ridge to come where the Germans are dug in, and it's push, 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 and that's it. That, you know, we'll do this week and then we'll have to do it again in another fortnight. And just as he sends culture down, maybe the culture's come back up from San Pietro to him, and he's thinking, this is too difficult. I'm finding this hard, because my men are finding it hard and all that. You know, it's because that is a two-way street after all. But it's his responsibility to do something about it.
Well, it is, and I think the problem is that once you start harboring these things, you just say, all I can see is a kind of brick wall of impossibility. You know, that starts to prey on your mind. It starts to cloud judgment. It stops you from kind of seeing the wood from the trees, and suddenly, what is always going to be a very, very tough situation, you're making tougher by not actually just taking a deep breath and figuring through this comedy. I mean, why aren't they using the anti-aircraft battalion in a ground attack role? Why aren't those tanks there? You know, the tanks are back at Mignano. What the heck? They're not even close. It's not like they're kind of loitering in a you know, just round the corner waiting to be caught. They are nowhere near it. And they're saying, why aren't we up there? We should be used. And that's got to come down on Walker's watch, surely.
Yeah.
It's really interesting because you've kind of flipped conventional wisdom on its head in a way, because Walker has been seen as kind of a soothsayer of anticipating this disaster that's going to happen that we lay at the feet of Hire, I guess, in posterity, certainly Clark and all that. Clark, you know, the Texans certainly blame Clark and all that, regardless of the truth. You know, there was the congressional inquiry, like you said, and it was often said that Clark couldn't go to Texas and all this, but...
Sorry, I mean, but isn't also a lot of that? I mean, isn't that why kind of when police round people up, they never put witnesses together? Because suddenly you sort of go, the point. Yeah, yeah, it's all his fault.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you want to make sure you're getting the same story when people are separated, yeah.
Right. What does your GI know about higher command? I mean...
Well, and I think the point you make about the level of support is the strongest point here. There's a lot of support for the 36th Division going across this river that we could compare with other river crossings quite favorably, I think. And you're right. I mean, the division commander really is responsible for this particular battle. The army commander is operating at a much higher level and, of course, dealing with Anzio, too, which is part of this whole larger kind of symphony that's happening. So Walker's part really is confined to what ends up as the worst fiasco here. And of course, it's in his interest maybe to spin it. But if we're being kind to him, you know, maybe this is just how he sees it. Maybe he's not conniving or anything. Maybe he's just saying this mission was just too much. I don't know how we could pull it off. And he was naturally going to sort of blame that on Hire because that's what you do in a military setting. They don't understand at Hire headquarters. Those knuckleheads at Corps, those knuckleheads at Division, those knuckleheads at Regiment, you know, all the way down the line.
Yeah.
That is the tendency, isn't it?
Yeah. But to flip it, what are the Germans getting right? You know, because previously they've been unable to stop the Allies at river crossings and stuff. So what are they getting right? Are the Germans doing something different that's thwarting and bamboozling the Americans in this instance, or is it?
Yeah, they've got the huge benefit of having Monte Cassino hovering over the whole thing with observers on top directing fire. They've also got, you know, they've got fire and depth there, you know, so they've got a lot of guns. They've got you've got outposts of MG posts and mortars. First of all, you've got wire entanglements and mines on the other side as well. Then you've got MGs and mortars. Then you've got kind of bigger mortars and you've got Nebelwerfers, which of course mortars as well. Then you've got your artillery, and the Germans know that the Americans are coming because they've seen them preparing for it. I mean, you know, the American Texas Division hasn't been terribly subtle about what they're doing.
Well, they know they have to have that, too. They have to have that crossing. They're not going to go straight into Cassino, like you said. Not yet. Across a river.
They kind of know what's coming. So they've packed it with, you know, probably the best division in the area, which is the 15th Panzergrenadier and our old friends from Sicily. And behind that is another division, the 44th. You know, and they can bring a lot of fire down there. But whatever fire the 15th and other German units in the area can bring to bear, it's as nothing compared to what the Americans can bring to bear on the Germans. The difference, of course, is that they're in their bunkers and trenches, and the Americans are having to sort of get up and expose themselves and cross open ground. That's the difficulty of it. But it's not just the point I'm trying to make is the fiasco is because of the confusion, because of the kind of sort of, you know, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, because of a whole host of things, which, you know, I would argue could have been avoided. And they don't have enough suppressive fire in the immediate kind of battle zone in the front. If you've got tanks hammering away with 75mm rounds and machine guns and two machine guns and doing that suppressive fire, then that would keep a lot of the Germans quiet. And that would be a massive enabler to the attacking infantry.
Well, and that's part of the quality of a commander that we tend to overlook, I think, is whether he's able to bring to bear all the assets he has at his disposal, which is not always easy to do logistically and transportation-wise, to get the tanks where they need to be at the exact time, to coordinate the artillery, to get the key fire support that you need when you need it right on site. This takes a lot of skill. You know, and especially in a night operation like this, and you're talking about a kind of funneling kind of battle here, where, you know, it's a pretty small area we're talking about where these guys are actually crossing and fighting, and yet you have all this support that has to physically occupy a larger space. How do you get it into play? How do you do it? You know, I mean, that's what I think some of the best commanders are masters at that, at coordinating all that. And I just don't know that Walker is in that category. You know, for instance, what I think about, just me thinking all these years later, you know, if you're not using those anti-aircraft battalions, those Quad 50s, you're really completely down on the job in this point, because that, to me, is your most powerful weapon for any night crossing. That kind of direct Quad 50 support that you've got is extraordinarily devastating to any German who hopes to fire back at you on the other side in those holes we're talking about. The machine gun posts you mentioned, you know, whatever it be. The heavier bunkers, okay, that's a different animal, but it's going to be anyway. But the Quad 50s are what are going to get you across that river, probably. Why aren't they in play to a better extent? To me, and of course, any division like Walker's has an organic anti-aircraft battalion that is equipped with a lot of this kind of stuff. So it's not just a matter of coordinating with units outside your division. Not just that, you know, these are part of your command too. Why aren't they there?
And the other thing is you've got two really good build-up points, because you've got Monte Trocchio, which runs north to south, which is in the southern bit of Monte Trocchio is just opposite where the 141st, so the northern crossing point over the Rapido, takes place. So you could hide a whole load of tanks and stuff, Sherman tanks, in there overnight the previous night, and they could be just lying up there and then move out at night and get into position and not kind of hold down position along the kind of railway line or right up by the river, for that matter, you know, in different parts of the river and just hold down there. And ditto on the other side. On the other side, you've got Monte Porcia, which is, you know, these two places which are just absolutely tailor-made. It's like having a whopping great wall behind which you can hide in the run-up to the attack. So it's not like they're kind of sort of advancing over 4 miles of a kind of sort of open river plain or anything. You know, they've actually got some geographical help here that could really make a massive difference. So the fact that those Sherman tanks from First Armored, from Combat Command B, are still back at kind of Mignano is just, it's disgraceful.
We need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a second.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome back to Weird Ways of Making You Talk. We're talking about the Rapido. We talked about this before, about this strategic imperative to push on all the time. It's pushing people into doing things. I mean, you know, you could argue, had he had another week, would he have been able to get this organized properly? Would the right council have arrived at the right moment? You know what I mean? That this endless strategic imperative to keep pushing and pushing and pushing means that you're deploying an underpowered division to try and...
Yeah, that is definitely true. There's no getting away from that. There isn't. And you know, we've talked about this before. This is the kind of the key problem of Italy, that you've just got too many... You've got the tyranny of Overlord overlooking the whole thing.
And
sort of pushing, forming, you know, forcing the pace. I mean, you know, this sort of get on with it and get to Rome as quickly as possible, do Anzio, that's coming from kind of Churchill and the Combined Chiefs of Staff, which then coming down to, you know, to Jumbo Wilson, who's the new Supreme Allied Commander, which is then coming down to Alexander as Army Group Commander, which is then coming down to Mark Clark. But I mean, you know, Mark Clark by this time, his Fifth Army is absolutely enormous, you know, because it's got most of Eighth Army in it as well, attached to it. Ten Corps has also got, you know, it's now got three divisions in it. On top of that, you've got 1st British Division attached to US 6th Corps. So that's four British divisions which are now operating in 5th Army. Plus, you've got the whole French Expeditionary Corps. Plus, you've got outsized kind of corps for 2 Corps and for 6th Corps. So it's a huge force. I mean, it's absolutely monstrous.
Well, and the other side's dealing with the same pressures. The Germans are too, of relentless, constant combat and, you know, of operations, right? I mean, both sides are dealing with it, this imperative to fight now.
So when we pull, you know, when the Allies pull a division out of the line, it's kind of for a month at least. When the Germans pull a division out of the line, it's 4 days. It's four days.
You know, the funny thing is that used to be lauded by World War II historians. The Germans had this great replacement system where they would keep the divisions, they would swap out units or whatever. They were destroying them, you know, in the U.S. Army replacement system, so heartless with individuals being fed into units and all that. And I would say, I would step back from that and say I think that the U.S. was more efficient in that respect 100%. And probably worked much better.
Oh my God.
And then in the end, it was maybe more humane because it did minimize the losses, even though it was tough to go there as an individual. Ideally, it's almost always better to go to the front line with your unit you've trained with or whatever. But this isn't possible during a world war. The Army surveys revealed that 2/3 of infantrymen in the Italian theater had not gone overseas with their unit. So the losses are such that you're going to have to bring new people in. What the German answer to this is simply leave them into the line until they get destroyed, take them out the line, reconstitute them, mainly with Eastern Europeans or whatever.
17-year-olds.
Or 17-year-olds, and then throw them back in to the wolves. I mean, I don't see a lot of merit in that relative to the U.S. system in that sense. You know what I mean?
Oh, my God. It's absolutely insane. It's insane. So there's this battalion commander in the 44th Focken Deutschmeister Division. Okay, check this out. So his regiment, the 134th Infantry Regiment, is seconded to the 29th Panzergrenadier. But his battalion is so wiped out that he then gets a company of the Hermann Göring Division attached to him to help bolster his number. So you've got a regiment from a different division now being given extra troops from another division to help the 29th Panzergrenadier Division. So it's like three steps down. I mean, it's just mad. Anyway, they get pulled out on the 14th of January. On the 16th of January, my battalion commander is then sort of called for a kind of sort of, you know, a divisional meeting where they sort of talk about stuff and warn them that they're going to have to go back up into the line in kind of, you know, 2 days' time. And says, you know, there's orders from on high, you know, we've got to re-educate everyone. You know, these young guys that are coming through, they don't believe in final victory. You know, we've got to re-educate them. And you know, that's why they're not, and because they don't believe in final victory and because they're not Nazi enough, that's why they're not fighting hard enough. The reason they're not fighting hard enough is because they're not trained and because they're 17.
Right, exactly.
It's very interesting, though, isn't it? Because this is often the sort of, Germans are really good. They're painted as they're really good at organizing new divisions. They're really good at stopgap forces. They're really good at that. Their command structures are brilliantly open to this, flexible. They can spin a new army round on a dime organizationally and throw one up. You kind of think, well, yeah, sure. But what do these armies consist of? And also what that tells you is that there's a whole bunch of people at the top who aren't involved in the actual sharp end, who are able to run these sort of virtual offices that then they plug formations into, which after all is why you end up with Hitler with a map with formations on that have names and flags on a map of Berlin, but there aren't any actual bloody people. You know, this is how he can end up.
Yeah, Steiner's attack.
Exactly, where's Steiner? Exactly. This is how he can end up saying, "Wo ist Steiner?" Because they've been selling him that these things are divisions, and he's been reading them on paper as divisions. And Jim, last year when you were talking about the Savage Storm, you were saying, what are divisions on paper? What do they actually constitute? Are they closer in size to one another or not? You know, if you're counting divisions, you get one picture, but then when you look at what they actually are made up of, you get something quite different. And once you actually burrow down into what they're constituted by. And yes, the German, you know, we've talked about this before. You know, the idea of the Kampfgruppe shows a sort of amazing organizational flexibility. It also demonstrates you're in the shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't have to be doing this, I guess, you know.
Well, my battalion commander, when he goes up to this meeting on the 16th, you know, they get warned that the two officers have just been shot for being drunk in front of their men. And so Zelda says, when do you actually not get shot? And kind of, you know, and everyone laughs.
I love that line.
That's when really do
you actually
funny.
Not get shot, you know? Just kind of curious.
And anyway, so the kind of regimental commander pats him on the back and says, look, you know, I know you've had a tough time, but, you know, we're going to make sure that when you go up the line in a couple of days' time, you get a kind of, you know, a quiet section. And he just goes, yeah, right, because there are quiet sections on this front.
Yeah, all everywhere. I mean, it's nothing happening here. Don't worry. So fascinating how you mentioned that they're saying, oh, these new guys are coming in. They don't believe in final victory. They're not properly viewed with the National Socialist spirit. That's so Hitlerian. I mean, that has to have come down from him because it's exactly what he thinks about this whole war. If you just believe enough in the indomitable will of National Socialism, then you will win somehow. It's just so crazy. I mean,
it's absolutely bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers. But the amazing thing is Kesselring does send it. So von Senger goes up to where the British attack on the Galliano, which is on the sort of south of the line, right by the Tyrrhenian Sea, so on the western coast. And he goes up to see Seinitz, who's the commander of the 94th Infantry Division. And he looks out from the top of the ridgeline down over the Galliano Plain and realizes that it's split and there's the Orsenta Valley, which goes up and joins the Liri Valley to the north. And that, you know, if the British can get onto this high ground, then they can potentially be in massive trouble. So he thinks the only way to do this is to say to Kesselring, who likes defending for every kind of last yard and absolutely adheres to the kind of Hitler missive, is if you don't massively reinforce this area right now, we're going to lose. And the Liri, you know, we won't be able to hold this line any longer. So he rings them up and Kesselring goes, absolutely, we must reinforce immediately. This is the most decisive moment of the whole Battle of Italy. And constantly sends all his reserves down to this point. So the 29th Panzer, which has only just been pulled out of the line, 90th, which has got completely destroyed at Ortona. And not happy with that, he then also sends the 1st Fallschirmjäger Corps, which at the time had been north of Rome. He now sends that south as well to the Galliano. They see this is absolutely the number one threat. Which means when the Allies land at Anzio, there really is nothing there.
Which means we get exactly what we want, and yet we don't get anything out of Anzio.
So I would argue that there's a couple of instances here where people are not, you know, decision makers are not necessarily making the right decisions on the Allied perspective.
But Jim, we were talking about this the other day amongst ourselves, is that so much of the intelligence story of the Second World War is a combination of wishful thinking, guesswork, and then basically cold cup of coffee in the face that, in fact, everything you thought up to this point is a load of nonsense. And that, you know, because after all, John, a thing that's happened in this country in the last couple of decades is we've taken on board the ultra story culturally, not in terms of history, but the ultra story has been taken on board kind of as this sort of reassurance that the British had, you know, we through our amazing brains and through a combination of sort of eccentrics and misunderstood geniuses, pipe smoking boffins, you know, and a series of, you know, innovations that led to the invention of the modern world. So, you know, the computer, blah, blah, blah. Because we cracked the ultra, the enigma thing, we knew everything. We knew, and our intelligence proceeds in this sort of platonic ideal of how intelligence works. We know everything. We've got it all worked out. And so when there are intelligence errors, it's like, how on earth did that happen? I thought we knew everything. Whereas in fact, again and again and again, you see that so much, you know, you look at the decision to invade Italy, Avalanche, the decision when to go, the simple timing on the assessment of what the Germans might do in the event of an Italian capitulation, it's all wishful thinking and guesswork. With a smattering of, well, we know that you know, we know where these units are, or we've heard that these units might be in the neighbourhood, but we don't know what they constitute, and which flings us back to the thing we were just talking about now, German paper formations or embryonic formations, you know, creating new armies, creating new visions, divisions from scrap. Intelligence briefing, it says that 9 and 10 Panzer SS might be in the neighbourhood. That could literally mean anything. That could mean a headquarters staff, or it could mean that there are armoured vehicles, it might not, or the Hermann Göring division when it's reconstituted to be sent to Sicily. What is it even? It's a letterhead at best, isn't it? And yet, British intelligence is reading those letterheads often enough in the communication, doesn't know what, you know, some of these, I mean, we, you know, when you look, when you compare it to the British effort Cascade to create these phantom armies and, you know, create this picture of all these armies moving around in the Mediterranean, the stuff that's at the British and Americans' disposal, the Germans is kind of doing that by accident because
much more haphazardly,
but yeah. Much more because their formations, do they exist? Do they not? Are they hollowed out? You know, they've been withdrawn, as you say, they've been winnowed away to nothing, withdrawn and being reconstituted. So what are they even? So the sort of the Germans by accident creating this intelligence picture that you can, you know, wetting your finger and holding it to the breeze as much if you're the Allies, even reading the Ultra, that after all, we reassure ourselves in this country, you know, clever old British brains, you know, knew what Hitler was having for breakfast. Well, yeah, maybe, but no, he didn't. And I think this is part of this picture, isn't it? Because if as you say, Jim, basically the moment for Anzio is the right moment and the Germans have sent everyone in the wrong direction and yet you don't make it pay off. Anyway, just all these conversations we've had lately that have kind of tangled themselves together into a way of thinking about this, I think is quite interesting.
Well, and it shows that a lot of things have to go right because even if we have Ultra, we're getting fragments of what they're communicating. They don't even know what's going on half the time too, so how are we going to? And so how are we going to take that actionable intelligence and utilize it with commanders in the field? So here we get a break, and the Germans have moved their troops away, conveniently away from our Anzio landing area, and we still don't pull it off. Not because people are idiots or something, because this is freaking hard to do, to line up all those ducks in the right rows, to get the intel, to figure it out the right way, to collect it together, to get it, make it actionable, to keep operational security too, by the way, because of course there's plenty of times when we can feed sometimes information to operational commanders, but we're worried, oh, maybe the Germans are going to figure out that we're cracking their codes. Is this worth it? You know, so we got that element too. So how's this going to get to me as a division or a battalion commander in a useful way? There aren't that many times in the war when this happens, honestly. I mean, Carentan, maybe. I think in a ground combat operational sense, for sure. Maybe in the Battle of the Atlantic, if we looked at it differently that way, maybe differently. Maybe there's the value, perhaps more. But we don't quite understand through Ultra Hitler's intentions a lot of times. Look at the Bulge again. And of course, obviously, they've gone dark on a lot of their communications by then too. But yeah, I mean, so in that sense, maybe Ultra is overcooked from a ground perspective. Yes.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, inevitably I've been, for my book, I've been looking at the orders, the enemy presence assessments in the orders for the British bit of Market Garden. First Parachute Brigade, there is no mention of any enemy formations at all. That just the enemy, there's some enemy and we, you know, expect some of them to show up perhaps. And then in the battalion orders, it says 9-10 Panzer SS divisions probably in the area, but we don't know. They're refitting round here, kind of, maybe. But the received wisdom within the battalion is that they were destroyed in Falaise. So, but they are mentioned in the battalion level orders. Their presence is, but where are they going to be? We don't know. Or what state are they in? We don't know. But we don't know anything.
We don't know anything
because we can't really know. There's no way that these are unknown knowns, aren't they, in that regard? You know they're there, but you don't know what they are. I mean,
Alan, haven't you noticed too, like, the closer you get to the ground combat soldier, like you said, battalion level or whatever, the more opaque those kind of intel matters tend to be. You know, enemy capability in this sector is X, Y, and Z. But we don't know for sure. I mean, you can really sympathize with a lot of these intel officers who are operating on, you know, half information. Imagine if we had to write books that way. Sometimes we do, I guess, but largely not. I mean, it would be very frustrating. So you can then see why there's such cynicism for the soldiers. They're like, they bollocks this up again. They don't know what the hell's going on. You know, especially when the Red Devils get to Arnhem and Oosterbeek, it's like, how could they not know these
guys
SS
here.
Units are here, right? It's like,
I'm going to Bletchley Park on Friday, so because I've got a show nearby, so I'm popping in, and I'm going to have that usual thing. I've said this to Jim before, John, that what happens is someone explains to me how the Enigma machine works, and then they explain how you decipher it, and for about half an hour, I hold that in my head.
and then it's gone.
And then by tea time in the evening, it's just gone. And
you and me, both.
If you ask me immediately, straight after I've had it explained to me, I'll be able to do it. And then 2 hours later, I've degenerated into Hitler's birthday or something. You know, they type in Hitler's birthday.
Oh, I don't feel as badly now because I'm the exact same way. Yeah, I don't know if I even ever understand it, but yeah, I think you're ahead of me on that, maybe. But absolutely,
it's imponderable. So Walker, is Walker's fatalism about this? Is he being? He's being in one way. He's sort of being realistic, isn't he? He's saying this is this is all difficult. We don't know, you know, in the end, they could tell me what the enemy presence is, but who knows, you know. To circle back round to Walker, though, because...
Yeah, okay, the point here is, yes, it's difficult. It's difficult. It's a nightmare. It's gonna cost a lot of blood. No one is denying that. Everyone's got their eyes wide open, but it is not impossible. That's the problem. You don't go into a battle thinking the battle you're about to undertake is impossible. That's a really, really bad attitude to have. And if you do think that, you should say it and you should make it absolutely clear and you should bug out and you say, well, I'm not going to do it. And you get sacked and someone else comes in.
What are his staff saying? Are they going, yeah, you're right, boss? Or are the staff going, well, you know.
Well, he says, I didn't let on my kind of, you know, my true feelings about all this. But you know, you're telling me that he didn't kind of let on to it. He wasn't sighing a lot and he wasn't kind of sort of scratching his nuts a lot. I mean, of course he was. I mean, of course they picked up the vibes. But he's not doing all that he could to give it the best possible chance because he's not thinking about those quad 50s. He's not thinking about the tanks. He's not thinking about using all the assets he's got. He's just not. And he's not thinking about, okay, let's really think sensibly about where we cross. You know, 143rd crossing place, okay, fine. Absolutely no problem with that at all. 141st is a bonkers place. No way. I mean, you know, you look at the maps, you look at the situation, you look at what's going on and you look at where they're crossing and you think, why are you doing this?
So Walker's fate, having messed this up, is what? Is he fired?
No, he cracks on. Everyone sort of pats him on the back and goes, you did your best job. And, you know, and he has a sort of cavalry moment because later on, it's the 36 Texans that find the gap in the Caesar line that enables them to fold up Rome. And it is the Texans that are responsible for getting Mark Clark out of the doo-doo for turning and pushing up through the Auburn Hills.
Right. So he gets his happy ending.
But if we look at this all these years later and we compare it to the 100 other successful river crossings we have before and after this, maybe that's the difference point. Walker, not to blame it all on him. I don't necessarily want to do that, but maybe there is some, maybe that's what's different. You have a commander who doesn't quite believe in this and is making decisions perhaps accordingly. But I think even whether he does or not, he's not using all his supporting elements, all of his assets he could use, that perhaps could have made a better difference there. I mean, I think in a way, maybe that's the most meaningful aspect of this, that we could compare it with other river crossings. And maybe if he has a failing, because you can understand why he's worried about it, of course, but if he has a failing, maybe that's it as much as anything.
Jim, when were you last there?
In April.
Standing there, can you see it?
It's very difficult because the Germans cleared all the kind of vegetation, so they had clear fields of fire and stuff, so it would have been absolutely sort of bare as anything. But what doesn't change is the lie of the land. So trees grow up and buildings go up and all the rest of it, but the kind of shape of the contours is exactly as it is, and it's not impossible. It's a tough nut, but it's not impossible.
In a country of tough nuts, is the thing.
Like Anzio, it's a tough nut, but the Albano Hills are there, you know, so there are workarounds, as we would now say, I guess, right? I mean... And that's why we laud some commanders and not others.
I think a more realistic scenario is if he'd got all his assets, is I think they could have got across the river. They could have got through the main line of resistance. I think they would have struggled to exploit because I don't think they had enough follow-up forces. You know, the forces are all spread out. I mean, could they have brought the Red Bulls down very quickly? Maybe. But, you know, I'm not sure that they had the follow-up forces, even if they had made a breakthrough.
Yeah, because they're going to Anzio.
But the flip side of that is, if you then land at Anzio and you've got a breakthrough on the Liri Valley, would that then have made Kesselring pull back? Now, I'm guessing not, because Kesselring doesn't retreat. I mean, that's not what he does. You know, and he's promised to Hitler that he wouldn't. So I'm not sure that it would have worked. But I, you know, how else do you break the deadlock when everyone's kind of saying you've got to do so, and you've got to kind of, you know, the clock is ticking and you've got to get to Rome quickly?
Well, Jim, I'm glad we dealt with the thing that no one knows about, or the problems, that the self-pity in that is really no one knows the problems I'm facing and isn't great, is it? And the investigation after the war found Clark not guilty, right? Or that's not the terms in which it was framed.
Oh, no, completely. Yeah, just threw it out immediately. Yeah. Clark asked permission from Eisenhower to go back to Washington to defend himself, and or Marshall, I can't remember one of them, and they just said, oh, don't even bother.
Well, but we've bothered. That's the main thing. It's just after all the point of this podcast.
Doesn't sound like it.
No, it doesn't sound like it. fantastic. Well, thanks, Jim. That was fascinating. Thanks, John. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you all again very soon. We hope you've enjoyed Jim unloading on the unfortunate Fred Walker. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
See you.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.